John Boy.
Lessons from the screen, what we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trash, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious. And we're here to keep you from them lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review, so you only spend time on the docs that you need to.
Welcome back to another episode of Lessons from the Screen. You know what it is, the show where we give you a review of whether or not a show, a document, a documentary, anything that you can get through any particular digital medium is worth your time. We waste our time, our energy, and our brain power so that you don't have to.
You're welcome.
Lessons from the Screen is brought to you by Paxing through the Freedom Train Network. You can find us at www.freedomtrainradio.com or on iTunes, Google Play Music, or Stitcher. I like Stitcher. I said that last week. I'm going to say it again. I like Stitcher. Go check us out on Stitcher if you don't want to go to the website, but you should go to the website. Drop us a line. Leave us a review on the website, on Stitcher, on Google Play, on iTunes. Go to all four places. Leave a comment. Leave a review. Let them know. Let's go. Anyways, be sure while you're on the internet, while you're doing all that, to head to www.pactsinc.org. That's PAXINC.org. To show some love and support for our sponsors, PAX Inc. is a black activist and advocacy organization focused on developing the black community through a shift in culture, education, and economics. As always, Lessons from the Screen has a frame of reference and perspective that is aligned with that of the black community. So the things we look at will be looked at with the racial component involved and with some lessons that can be used to improve the community. During this episode of Lessons from the Screen, we will be jumping into Trump's address. He addressed the nation on March 19th, talking about the opioid crisis. We're going to be talking about what this could potentially mean for black people, as well as some of the differences and similarities between the old war on drugs and the new war on drugs. We will give you some of the key points, and then we will give you our opinion of those points and of the speech in general. In this week's episode of Lessons from the Screen, we will be addressing the new war on drugs. Now, an interesting note here is that the backdrop to Trump's speech is a deep blue tinted mural of people with the words opioids, the crisis next door, in big bold white letters. So that's the backdrop that he's standing in front of. And after a standard round of thanking politicians and the Trumpian round of thanking law enforcement agencies, because you know he's tough, minus of course the intelligence agencies, and with a particularly special emphasis on those that work directly with keeping immigrants out of the country. So we're talking about Border Patrol, we're talking about ICE and various things like that. He thanked law enforcement agencies for protecting Americans, keeping out drugs, and holding the line against criminals. He moved into his speech with compassion for the victims of opioids and their families. Now, the next point, after he did all that, he began with his very strong language, because you know he's a very strong guy. In very strong tonation, he declared that the scourge of addiction in this country will stop. He said that strong, very strong. He followed it up with a statistic, and this one is actually true. That's why I'm going to repeat it, because it's so rare that we get anything true from this president, or at least true in the sense of not only is it factually right, but it's contextually accurate. Because sometimes he'll say things and they might be factually right, but they'll be contextually misleading. But in this case, that wasn't the case. So he said that every day 116 Americans die from an opioid-related overdose. And he followed up that little bit of truth by saying, declaring, mind you, that we will raise a generation of children free from addiction. He then moved on and spoke about the 70,000 plus illegal immigrants tried and convicted on drug-related charges. He spoke about Operation Granite Shield, which, for those of you who don't know, it was a statewide drug operation in New Hampshire, which is one of the worst affected states when it comes to the opioid crisis. And after months of work, they arrested more than 150 people, captured close to 18,000 doses of heroin and fentanyl worth about $22,000, 24 weapons, $37,000 in cash, as well as other drugs. Now, the operation was a coordination of 88 local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies, and the program cost over $1 million to run. He spoke about getting tough on drug dealers, spoke on utilizing the death penalty, framed the discussion as he told the story about drug dealers being able to kill thousands and thousands of people and only getting 30 days in jail. And he spoke to winning the battle and not wanting to leave in 7 years and still having the problem. The obvious assertion there is that he's going to win a second term. And he spoke on a three-pronged approach focusing on prevention, law enforcement, and education. So some of the things that he talked about doing, wanting to do, having already done various other things, as he spoke about reducing the demand by preventing addiction to include coming up with painkillers that aren't addictive. And at this point, he brought up his first set of human props, who talked about their kid, and they all called him a kid. He had a degree in actuary science, found some leftover painkillers in his parents' kitchen drawer, and got addicted and later died of an overdose. He talked about addressing the problem of overprescribing. He wants to cut nationwide prescriptions by a third over the next year and bring federal cases against pharmaceutical companies spending money on commercials that vilify drug use. Now, I know I said that kind of weird, and that's because my brain is operating kind of funky right now. He doesn't want to bring federal cases against drug companies that are spending money on commercials. Those are two separate points. He wants to bring federal cases. He's talking about maybe, I don't say he wants to, I'll say he's talking about maybe bringing federal cases against pharmaceutical companies that create, manufacture, and distribute addictive drugs. And he is also talking about spending money on commercials that basically vilify drug use. Like, you know, we used to have the old, I don't know if all of you guys are old enough to remember this, and I'm sure a lot of you are, the whole this is your brain, and then they crack the egg, and then they put the egg in a skillet that's frying hot, and they scramble the egg a little bit, and they say this is your egg on brain on drugs. Any questions? Stuff like that, that just vilify drugs and make people not want to do drugs anymore. He's launching a new website. The government is launching a new website, crisisnextdoor.gov, where Americans can share their experiences with drugs and drug addiction. He's talking about reducing the supply of illicit drugs, and this is where he made a sharp pivot to what he likes to talk about most, which is building the wall. He spoke to the fact that 90% of the heroin comes through our southern border, and he wants to build the wall, at which point the New Hampshire audience started to chant, build the wall. Build that wall, build the wall, or build that wall, or something along those lines. It was silly to me. Anyways, he attacked sanctuary cities and accused them of protecting criminals, and talked about Lawrence, Massachusetts, in particular, which is a sanctuary city. He says supplies fentanyl to six cities in New Hampshire. Talked about MS-13 having 15 members arrested in Lawrence. And then he brought up his second human prop, which was an ICE agent that helped uncover the drug operation in Lawrence, Massachusetts. He talked about shutting down illegal digital marketplaces that bring in drugs from places like China. Go figure, he mentions China. Said that if we're nice, we won't have a country left. And spoke about bringing back the death penalty. Said that he had heard from other countries who have told him that they kill their drug dealers, so they don't have a drug problem. Of course, he never bothered to mention who those countries were. But he spoke about actions against manufacturers, but didn't define what those actions might be. He talked about getting life-saving help to those that need it, praised Adapt Pharma for creating Narcan, an opioid overdose drug. They provide 4 boxes free to every college in the U.S. and 2 boxes free to every high school in the U.S. And the vast majority of drug overdoses in the U.S. happen at home, not at school. So I guess everything is something. He spoke about increasing treatment options and also talked about making prescription drugs more affordable. I'm not quite sure what that has to do with getting the opioid thing under control. It seems like it might make it worse if you make them cheaper, but okay, whatever. He had the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, come up. Alex Azar is actually a lawyer and a former executive of Eli Lilly, a very, very powerful, prominent, and successful drug manufacturer, pharmaceutical company here in America. It's the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Amazing, right? I know. He then talked about the Right to Try program that he is trying to get passed for terminally ill patients. This program would give them the right to seek experimental drugs to save their life. Again, I'm not quite sure what that has to do with the opioid crisis, but okay. And then he talked about trying to get Medicaid freed up to pay for people who need treatment from facilities with more than 16 beds. This is another one of those. I'm not real sure how that connects. Well, you know what? I get it because if Medicaid won't pay for your overdose treatment plan, then maybe that's a connection there. Okay. And then he talked about hiring inmates, which I'm guessing and would keep them from selling opioids. So I don't think doctors, I'm not real sure how many ex-con doctors there are in America, but that'd be an interesting figure to look up. Don't you think? I'm pretty sure. Obviously I'm being facetious. So moving forward, he talked about a lot of things in this 40-minute lecture, this 35-40 minute address, and the last roughly 10 to 15 minutes of it had very little to do with the opioid problem. But he talked. He did give out some things I had agreed with in terms of the practicality of them and the philosophy and theory behind how they could impact the drug trade, the illegal drug trade. But it's Donald Trump. And I know that me being a black man, he's not overly concerned about doing anything that's going to benefit me. And that's not even as a man. That's just as a black person. So the mention of China is interesting considering the various economic, social, and political battlefields that his administration is stomping into with China currently. This seems like a very nicely unsubtle piece of propaganda to kind of start to redirect the American people's focus onto China, especially with regards to the drug situation in America, something that they typically have not really paid China much attention on. So we'll look to see where he goes with that. But the tonation of this speech was a lot like his other speeches, strong statement, strong demeanor, strong tonation, because Trump is a really, really strong guy. Okay. He's just a strong dude. Well, or he wants to appear strong. Yeah, whatever. He spoke about winning often and made sure that this was emphasized as a battle. Even his one of his human props, the ICE agent, came in and literally all he said was, yeah, it's been a tough battle. This has been a battle. It's been a tough battle. A battle, tough battle. It's been a battle. The FBI, the tough battle. Which was interesting that the ICE prop said FBI, considering. Anyways, we'll leave that alone for now. So he made sure that we knew that this was a battle in his mind, a war that he wanted to win. hence me calling this episode A New War on Drugs. Of course, that's only if you believe the old war on drugs actually ended, in which case I guess this would be more appropriate to be called a recommitment, a renewal. The government's renewing their vows on drugs. Wait, that doesn't sound right. All right, whatever. So the very first thing that I thought was really interesting was the framing of the opioid epidemic as the crisis next door. The reason this is interesting is because, well, drug issues have historically been framed as those people over there are bad people. They're stuck on drugs. That's why they're like that. So to see this kind of personalizing this in this way, and it really does fit with the narrative of this being a health and human service crisis and not a crime epidemic, as it usually is when drugs affect non-white people. Also of interest, of course, as I pointed out, was the thinking of law enforcement with the emphasis on those that deal with immigrants and the skipping of those that deal with intelligence. Now, I'm not saying that to say that Trump is stupid. I'm saying that to say that, well, Trump is. No, Trump is actually a lot smarter than I think people give him credit for. But he does have a beef right now with the entire American intelligence apparatus, the entire intelligence community, the FBI, the CIA, you name it. So I thought it was interesting that these same organizations are involved in a lot of these initiatives that he loves to praise, but he often praises everyone but them. So that's always interesting anytime it happens. And of course, it happens every time he speaks. So, you know, it is what it is there. Now, to me personally, it's always interesting when Trump tries to appear compassionate because he just doesn't do it very well. And I'm sure he would say, you know, he's the most compassionate person to ever walk the face of the universe or something like that. But, you know, that's just part of his personality, his competitive nature, his, you know, bigger is better, better is best, and I'm the best type deal that he has going on. But he does not do compassion very well. So it's always interesting when his human props were coming up and they were telling their stories, which the stories are horrible stories. You never want to hear about anybody dying or anything like that, especially, you know, drug related overdoses and things of that nature. But just looking at him appear to be compassionate, it is just amusing to me. And it's usually occurring at all the wrong moments, because when you're trying to be compassionate is because something deeply disturbing is being conveyed and you want to convey a sense of empathy. That is not a good time to be making your audience laugh with your pathetic acting ability. So we're moving forward. He spent a lot of time speaking about illegal immigrants compared to what this address was supposed to be about. And that's something that I do think we need to pay attention to. His favorite speaking point being MS-13. And I'm not saying that MS-13 isn't a dangerous group of people, but I am saying that they account for less than 1% of the total Mexican immigrant community. So the way he frames the MS-13 discussion, it would have people believing that the entire Mexican immigrant community is MS-13. Like, if you're an illegal immigrant in this country and you're brown, you're MS-13. That's the way he speaks. And this is the same type of narrative and scare tactics that got him elected by paranoid white people that fear losing power. And it's the same narrative that drives the far right, a.k.a. the alt-right, a.k.a. white supremacists, a.k.a. foreign country white boys that hate everybody that ain't white, a.k.a. white nationalists, a.k.a. Big Bubba shoot that nigga. Okay, I just made that one up. But it's the same narrative that's been used against black people countless times to massacre entire towns of black people. And another message he echoed repeatedly that has been historically used to drum up support for violent activity against the black community is the narrative of toughness, the belief that the only thing these people understand is toughness, aka violence. The old, I can kick your ass since you won't do what I want you to do just by me talking to you. So I'm going to beat submission into you. That narrative is ever present. It's ever present from the inception of America. That's been the narrative towards non-white people in America, and even towards some white people in America, but especially towards non-white people in America, because at some point in history, every white person has gotten a pass, and that has not trickled down. Yeah, you know, another example of trickle-down economics not working, right? So he spoke to a three-pronged approach, but the core of his address was toughness and strongly anti-immigrant. And when I say anti-immigrant, I do stress that he does harp on Mexico a lot, and that's because that's one of the things he got voted on. But Trump has made it clear he does not want any immigrants from black or brown countries. No African immigrants, no South American immigrants, no Mexican immigrants, no freaking, you know, he probably thinks that the blacks, aka black Americans, are immigrants that need to be removed as well. So, you know, like, this is what we're dealing with, this is what we're talking about, and this address was filled with talking points and dog whistle issues for white nationalists, rhetoric that would get them fired up, rhetoric that would have them talking. His attacking sanctuary cities does very little to help the drug-related problems in America right now. The speech, again, was more of a dog whistle filled with dog whistle terminology for white supremacists. And then let me go back, because let's talk about the fact that he brought up his Health and Human Services secretary, who is a lawyer. And Lord knows, look, I got to tell you, I really despise lawyers right now, especially. And it's not that anything is happening to me, but as a black person, I'm seeing so many different things happening to so many of my comrades, my friends, my brothers and sisters, my black people. I'm seeing so many different things that are happening to them. And I'm seeing so many lawyers take advantage of their situations to squeeze money out of them, to squeeze fame and notoriety out of them, and them not getting anything in return and feeling defeated and feeling outsmarted and feeling outwitted and just in general feeling horrible about themselves because they had a negative interaction with white people and white supremacy, and they expected to get justice in the legal system because a lawyer convinced them that they could achieve something that the lawyer was clearly not interested in achieving. So lawyers, in my opinion, like police, I have a big problem with police officers. And lawyers, in my opinion, are only a half shade more honorable than police officers right now, in my opinion. And they might not even be more honorable than police officers. Like, just as bad as the police department is and their brutalization and humiliation tactics towards black communities all over America, every time a cop does that, a lawyer is complicit. Because a lawyer will defend them, the justice system will get them off, and a lawyer will do a poor, piss-poor, improper job of representing their black clients in those same court settings. So I have a real issue with lawyers right now. But anyways, that's off the topic. So the Secretary of Health and Human Services is a lawyer and former pharmaceutical executive. And he was a leading figure in the very same sector that's causing all of these problems to begin with. And his position is not permanent, which means that following a natural course of logic, he knows that he's going to leave eventually. And unless he becomes some sort of special interest type person, which I'm sure he would be for the pharmaceutical industry, he's trying to set something up to where it's going to be better for him when he leaves office. I seriously doubt this guy is honestly looking out for the well-being of all Americans. Why isn't the Secretary of Health and Human Services somebody that's at least familiar with or studied in medicine? We all know doctors aren't experts. We know that. But I tend to think they might know a little bit more about health and human services than a lawyer. I mean, a sociologist, a psychologist, a therapist, somebody from the health or the human services sector. I don't get it. I do get it. But this show isn't about that. So let's also talk about the blatant and often spoke about difference between this and drug problems in non-white communities. And this is a historical issue. We're not just talking about the war on drugs in the 70s and 80s. No, we could go back even further. We could go back even further to the marijuana. We could go back even further to opium. Both of those dealt with Hispanic communities, Latin communities, and Chinese communities. We can go back even further. We can list out the drugs, and that would be a whole interesting show in and of itself. But every single time something starts to affect the white community, we see a shift in the narrative. This is how most of these drugs became illegal. So here's the deal, right? Because I can go on and on with this lecture and really lay into it. But I don't think any of us trust Trump to begin with. But I want us to make sure that we are eyeing the entire government, local officials as well, because this is basically a revamped war on drugs. And clearly, this was painted as a war in the lecture, in the address. I'm sorry, I keep picturing it as a lecture for like white nationalists, which is how it came off to me. Anytime white people go to war, black people usually die or become prisoners of war. And that's usually because we aren't prepared for the altercation to begin with. And we aren't prepared for this one. Donald Trump is going to leave office at some point. This is true. But his policies, his tone, his example, and all of the people that he's empowered, and all of those congressmen, congresswomen, and those local politicians that have been empowered by him and influenced by him will still be there. And they will still be singing his message, which is a message that's been in the undercurrents of American society forever. We could spend a few shows giving you all the reasons why what I'm about to say is true and necessary, but I don't think we need all those reasons right now. So I'm just going to say it. If ever there was a reason for us to get involved in local politics, to pay attention to national politics, to start building local organizations and connecting them to and through national organizations, and to start building community, then that time absolutely, absolutely has to be right now. I want to thank you guys for tuning into this episode of Lessons from the Screen. Make sure that you go to the website. Make sure you check out all of the shows. www.freedomtrainradio.com. We will see you guys next week with another episode of Lessons
from the Screen. What we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trash, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious. And we're here to keep you from them lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review, so you only spend time on the docs that you need to.